Disc 2. I don't defer to teachers or teachings. Wow. That sounds like I'm already pretty intolerant, so maybe it's something I should expand on a bit. Here's the deal. I am fully enlightened, fully truth realized. I am here, live, on the scene, and I have chosen to describe it as I see it. I don't defer. I don't rely. If what I describe conflicts with the 10,000 other reports, no matter how revered those reports and those who filed them may be, then to me those reports are nothing more than fable and folklore and should be consigned to the dust heap of history. The simple fact is that I am here, and here doesn't look all that much like anyone says it does, and I'm not going to waste my time or anyone else's pretending otherwise. It should be noted that here isn't mist enshrouded or poorly lighted. It's neither mysterious nor mystical. My knowledge is unflawed and my vision is unobstructed. This is a tricky point to make, but a critical one. I am not interpreting. I am not translating. I am not handing something down that was handed down to me. I'm here, now, telling you what I see in the most straightforward possible terms. If that sounds harsh, then get used to it. This is a harsh business. I'm not writing this book to make money or gain followers or to be popular. I'm writing it to get it out of my system. My message isn't that you should believe me about what it's like here, but that you can come see for yourself. You shall no longer take things at second or third hand, nor look through the eyes of the dead, nor feed on the specters in books. You shall not look through my eyes either, nor take things from me. You shall listen to all sides and filter them from yourself. Walt Whitman. Returning to Paul's transition, the analogy of a caterpillar, chrysalis, butterfly transformation is also apt. We must rely heavily on analogies. The Tao that can be told is not the eternal Tao, and all that. Unlike the newly emerged butterfly, however, the freshly enlightened have no primal instinct to inform and guide them. When I myself went through this experience, I knew it was immense. I knew it was uncommon in the extreme. I knew it was the supreme accomplishment, beside which all others paled to insignificance. I could look at or listen to any person and know instantly that they hadn't been through it yet. And yet, I wasn't to know for years that it was enlightenment. Damned peculiar. When I finally did put it together, it was a very comforting, albeit mind-boggling, earth-shaking, paradigm-shifting realization. I had spent years as a closet butterfly, moping around with caterpillars and dreaming highly fictionalized dreams of becoming a butterfly. I knew that I was distinctly different from the caterpillars. I knew that an uncrossable chasm separated us, that I wasn't one of them anymore, that they weren't like me, nor I like they. I knew I was able to communicate with them only in the most superficial sense, based on my rapidly fading memories of their language and habits. What it took me a while to understand, though, was that the reason I wasn't one of them anymore was because I was something else, and that the difference was absolute. I had earned admission to a whole new reality, but I hadn't yet passed into it because no one explained to me that this new order of being I had become was what caterpillars meant when they said butterfly. After all, who is there to explain such a thing to someone who doesn't even know enough to ask? Damned peculiar. How is such a state of ignorance and confusion even possible? Simply put, caterpillars are egregiously misinformed on the subject of butterflies, just as we see in the novels and film that humans are egregiously misinformed on the subject of vampires. And who's to correct them? Vampires don't hang out with humans. Vampires don't return to educate humans, don't mingle with humans, don't care one way or another what humans think. Why should they? They're beings of an entirely different order, with only the most superficial similarity to the order of beings to which they once belonged. And that's very much what the Enlightenment thing is like. Instead of vampires and butterflies, just imagine being the only adult in a world of children. Really. Imagine how you'd develop over the years. Imagine how your feelings about children might change. Imagine the person you'd become. Damned peculiar. How many people actually get this far? How many people are really enlightened? Many claim it. But how many actually are it? I have no idea, but I would guess very few. Some of those in a position to speculate have estimated that 1 in 10,000 take to the idea, and 1 in 10,000 of those actually make it, meaning 1 in 100 million. Thinking worldwide and time-wide, I'd agree that it's in that range, that there are a few dozen truth-realized beings alive on Earth at any time. And how many of those few dozen, like myself, make an effort to assist others, make themselves known? Less. That's quite understandable, really. Once you get past the notion that duality, by any name, is bad, and unity, by any name, is good, you also get past any need to help or save anyone. I, for instance, don't do what I do because I think it needs doing. I am moved by no ethical or altruistic motive. I don't think something is wrong and that I have to make it right. I don't do it to ease suffering or to liberate beings. I do it simply because I'm so inclined. I have a built-in urge to express what I find interesting. And the only thing I find interesting is the great journey that culminates in abiding non-dual awareness. I heard that Maharishi Mahesh Yogi was very happy with his reclusive life in the foothills of the Himalayas and may never have rejoined society, but that he began hearing the name of an Indian city in his head. It simply appeared, unbidden, in his thoughts. When he finally mentioned it to someone, they advised that the only way to get the name of the town out of his head was to go there. He did, got swept into a speaking engagement, and the whole transcendental meditation movement grew out of it. That makes sense to me. You observe events, and you allow the flow of things to do the steering, and you go where you go. So here I am, knowing something that other people want to know and, in this particular instance, being in the right place to say some things that will simplify life for Paul at this point in his journey. There isn't much precedent for a person to stop being one kind of being and start being another, and no one is ever prepared coming into it. It may be absurd to speak of it, but it's far more absurd to live it. If this all sounds exceedingly strange, let me assure you, it is. And it's something I prefer not to let others struggle with when I see them freshly emerged from their 2 years, give or take, of soul-wrenching conflict. So, as Paul and I stood in front of the house and that glorious crystalline night, I was pleased to say to him, "Welcome." We spent the next hour discussing weird things like vampires and butterflies and solitude, and the next day and the next decade. You get the gateless gate thing now? I asked. Oh, he said, as comprehension dawned in him. He laughed. Which is about all you can do. I didn't say anything. I wasn't teaching now. I wasn't trying to draw him out or guide him toward certain realizations. He'd already done it all. I was no longer Paul's teacher. He had destroyed me as his teacher. In a very true sense, he knew every bit as much as I did. Enlightenment isn't like graduating high school, only to start college, or even finishing college to enter the real world. It's the final graduation. No more hunt, no more chase, no more battle. Now you can go out in the world and do whatever you want. Learn guitar, jump out of airplanes, write books, tend grapes, whatever. Our teacher-student relationship was over. This conversation was just one guy who'd been around for a while showing the new guy the ropes. Chapter 6. It's all about Oz, baby. Seizing my life in your hands, you thrashed it clean on the savage rocks of eternal mind. How its colors bled until they grew white. You smile and sit back. I dry in your sun. Rumi. The house is like a small community. People come, stay for a week or a year. Friendships form. Difficult goodbyes are said. I'm sure the relationships in the house are deeper and more complex than I describe, but I'm pretty insulated from the day-to-day affairs of the household and its occupants, and that's a good thing. For the last 5 months or so, we've had a mother and daughter with us. The mother, Marla, is one of the many who show up with pretty distorted views about what enlightenment is. I can't really teach her anything for now. I can only encourage her to take a look at her basic assumptions and develop a willingness to revisit them in a new light. As is often the case, she'll probably prefer her romanticized beliefs over the harsher realities and move on rather than change. The misconception about enlightenment stems from, or is at least compounded by, the fact that most of the world's recognized experts on the subject of enlightenment are not enlightened. Some are great mystics, some are great scholars, some are both, and most are neither, but very few are awake. This core misconception will be a big theme in this book because it's the primary obstacle in the quest for enlightenment. Nobody's getting there because nobody knows where there is, and those who are entrusted to point the way are, for a variety of reasons, pointing the wrong way. At the very heart of this confusion lies the belief that abiding non-dual awareness, enlightenment, and the non-abiding experience of cosmic consciousness, mystic union, are synonymous when, in fact, they're completely unrelated. It's possible to have either without the other, and there are countless millions of cases of mysticism and cosmic consciousness of varying degree for every one case of enlightenment. Of course, true cases of enlightenment are unlikely to attract attention to themselves, so it is certain that there are more than is apparent, like vampires. However, the simple fact remains that enlightenment and mysticism have little or nothing in common. Anyone, myself included, who has had a taste of mystic union will naturally assume it to be the very summit of human experience, which I believe it is. It would follow from there that anyone who enjoyed more frequent access or greater ease of access to such a rarefied state would be at or near the summit of humanity. All well and good until such a one is labeled spiritually enlightened. He or she may be a divine avatar, or love incarnate, or the supreme Godhead, but enlightenment is something else. The critical distinction is that one is in the dream and the other is not. One is truth realized and the other is not. One is within consciousness and one is independent of consciousness. The enlightened have awakened from the dream and no longer mistake it for reality. Naturally, they are no longer able to attach importance to anything. To the awakened mind, the end of the world is no more or less momentous than the snapping of a twig. The wise see the same in all, says the Gita. The wise are impartial, says the Tao. The enlightened cannot conceive of anything as being wrong, so they don't struggle to make things right. Nothing is better or worse, so why try to adjust things? Members of movie audiences don't leap out of their seats to save characters in the film. If the movie shows an asteroid blazing toward the Earth, the screen remains unscorched, and the moviegoers don't race home to spend their final hours with loved ones. If they did, they would be hauled off to the nearest mental health facility and treated for a delusional disorder. The enlightened view life as a dream. So how could they possibly differentiate between right and wrong, or good and evil? How can one turn of events be better or worse than another? Of what real importance is anything in a dream? You wake up, and the dream is gone as if it never was. All the characters and events that seemed so real have simply vanished. The enlightened may walk and talk in the dream world, but they don't mistake the dream for reality. Enlightenment is about truth. It's not about becoming a better or happier person. It's not about personal growth or spiritual evolution. An accurate ad for enlightenment would make the toughest Marine blanch. There is no higher stakes game in this world, or any other, in this dimension, or any other. The price of truth is everything. But no one knows what everything means until they're paying it. In the simplest terms, enlightenment is impersonal, whereas what is commonly peddled as enlightenment is personal in the extreme. We'll cover this in more detail as we go, since I guess that's what my life and the house and this book are all about. Suffice it to say for now that one of the most mission-critical tasks on the road to enlightenment is figuring out what enlightenment is not. It's funny who gets into the house and how they come. Apparently, you don't just show up with your bags and make yourself at home. Marla came from California with Annie, her 7-year-old daughter, to be here. She heard about it through the grapevine or from someone else who had been here or something like that. But Sonea doesn't let people in that easily. I didn't know all this until Annie explained it to me. Marla and Annie were sent to a rooming house in town and were advised to come out for daily visits to see how they took to things and how things took to them. Annie also told me how things like chores, meals, bathroom schedules, and other such household matters worked. She seemed to have a pretty good handle on all of it, and I was surprised, as always, to get a glimpse of what a complicated ship Sonea was running and how skillfully she ran it. "Do you like Sonea?" I asked Annie. "Sonea is love," Annie replied, as if the question were too stupid to ask, which, I suppose, it was. Sonea arrived 5 years ago and simply took over. In the first few months of her time here, I learned that she had been with the International Society for Krishna Consciousness for about 25 years. She had run households and kitchens when she was with them, too. Her devotions hadn't shifted, she once explained to me. When she was with them, she wasn't really with them, but with Krishna. And now she wasn't really with me, but with Krishna. I got it. Not immediately, but eventually I realized that in all things, in every action, in every second of every day, she was practicing a conscious devotion to her Lord. It might look like she was cooking for the group, or washing floors for her own sense of cleanliness, or managing the complexities of a diverse group of people for the benefit of those people, or running an accidental ashram for me. But once I got the hang of her and really started paying attention to the way she paid attention to, well, everything, then I saw it. She was present in every moment, and every moment was a devotion to Krishna. It had nothing to do with me, or the house, or the whole whatever's going on here thing. Sonea was doing what Sonea did, and this was just the place where she did it. And who or what was Krishna to her? Was he the blue-skinned youth of portraits? Arjuna's charioteer? Vishnu? Brahma? I don't know. Sonea has never been my student in any sense. She has never asked me anything, and I have never been tempted to translate her world view into my terms or mine into hers. She has the most beautiful and fully integrated faith I have ever been privileged to observe. She could command armies or govern nations with the same apparent ease with which she runs this house. She shines. She is always radiant and soft, even when she's being hard. If there's a mystic in our household, it's Sonea. She's the mystical one. She possesses effortless correctness and imperturbability at all times and in all things. She is above and beyond the tasks and chores in which she is constantly absorbed. She, like me, is a different order of being, but neither caterpillar nor butterfly. I don't know what that makes her, but I am profoundly grateful to have her near. From my point of view, of course, Sonea was heaven sent. There is no house without Sonea, no book, no me prattling on and on. Well, I'd still be prattling, but probably only with a slightly malnourished and deathly bored dog for an audience. I love this planet and this universe and this whole human thing, and one of the reasons I love it is because of the magic that holds it all together. When I look at Sonea, I see that magic most clearly. Annie delights me. I'm not really able to form attachments with adult humans, but cats, dogs, and children are a different matter. Annie leads me by the hand through the gardens and behind the summer kitchen and down to one of the ditches that run along the road. The property is full of mysteries and wonders that she must share, or else she will simply burst as new mysteries and wonders constantly pour in. I'm her relief valve of the moment. As long as she reports to someone the exact wonderfulness of each wonder, she can cross it off her burgeoning list and move on. There's no time for me to take a closer look at the deer prints in the mud of an adjacent farm field, because we have to get over to the mailbox to take note of a spider web, complete with spider and captured prey. Then, to the largest of the oaks on the property, to see an abandoned bird's nest. Then to the river birches, to see an inhabited bird's nest. And we have to hurry, or else we won't have time for follow the leader before meditation. A little judicious route planning might have economized our energy expenditures, but Annie is fabulously well-to-do in this regard and naturally unmindful of those less fortunate. Nevertheless, I am able to hold my own for the first 2 or 3 minutes of Follow the Leader. After that, the somersaults, cartwheels, bunny hops, puddle stomps, and imaginary hopscotch begin to take their toll, and I am forced to retire to the less strenuous pursuits of gasping and moaning. I collapse into the grass to await the arrival of stretcher-bearers. Annie helps me wait by sitting on my chest and bouncing. Meditation is 5:30 to 7 p.m. No one is required to meditate, but everyone is asked to be quiet during this period. I don't meditate much, and when I do, it's usually early in the morning, so I like to take advantage of this quiet period to sit on the front porch or in the living room. It's generally understood that this is a time when I'm available to anyone who wants to talk. Sometimes one person comes along and focuses on their stuff of the moment, and sometimes a group will form, and a broader dynamic will play out. I don't have a preference. It's usually a pleasant time for me. The material I teach presents no problems or challenges for me. That's what being a master means, I suppose. I know this stuff front and back, in and out. I could teach it in my sleep, and maybe I do. What is a challenge is how the information is received. Most or all of what I say fits into the receiving brain in a particular place, but there's always something already there. It's never an empty slot just waiting to be filled. Not only will every slot already be filled, but there will also be security, probably very tight security, guarding it. If I taught English Lit to eighth graders, it would just be a matter of keeping it interesting so the connection stayed open while I unloaded new info. But this is different. No one comes here for their first exposure to the spiritual dimension. Everyone comes pre-educated, and the education they arrive with is, for all practical purposes, worse than useless. That's what I deal with, and I'm not a master of cranial lock-picking. I just try hard to do my bit and know that success and failure is out of my hands. It's amazing how desperately we cling to our beliefs. As history shows, the fastest way to reduce otherwise decent people to a state of savagery is by tampering with their belief system. The word for someone who does so is heretic, and historically the punishments reserved for him are more brutal than for any other class of offender. The point is that by the time people come to me, their beliefs are securely in place. No one approaches me and asks to have their hard-won beliefs demolished. They come to build upon what they already have and to continue along the course they've already begun. Demolition, though, is exactly what they need. If, that is, they want to wake up. But that's a very big if. How many of them really want what it really is? My opinion is that only a fraction of 1% of seekers of enlightenment are even pointed in the right general direction. I would also say, however, that the percentage is slightly higher if you're looking at the group that has made it to this house or to this book, to me and this message. At the time of this writing, the message you find in this book and that I share with our guests at the house, enlightenment stripped of its spiritual trappings, is uncommon in the extreme. I say that a higher percentage of people sitting with me or holding this book desire enlightenment for what it really is, because we all get what we need when we need it. If the universe has set you in front of me or put this book into your hands, then in all likelihood you are closer than most to honestly confronting the stark reality of your situation. It works both ways. When the teacher appears, the student is ready. Very seldom does someone come along who has already started down the path I extol. Paul was an example of one who did. He was already in the right mindset and well on his way. For him, I was a counselor, a gentle guide and a reassuring voice in the relentless battle he was waging. But that's a rare exception. Most of those who come to the house have already bought into or been sold on the whole sweetness and light spirituality thing. They want to become better people, more open, more loving, happier, closer to God, and they want to achieve spiritual enlightenment because, as everybody knows, that's where the spiritual path leads. The yellow brick road may be a trip, but it's all about Oz, baby. They've been sold on the enlightenment thing, and that's what they want. I don't know what they think enlightenment really is, because I only have them to go by, and they don't know. I ask, and I usually get the same vague answers about higher consciousness, Tat Dvam Asi, unity, bliss, oneness, no mind, and so forth. They peddle the same stuff to me that someone else peddled to them with no real understanding being developed during the layover. Small wonder, since, to borrow from Gertrude Stein, there's no there, there. What they're describing is, for the most part, a whimsical, mythological sort of heaven Shangri-La nirvana for the Hindu-Buddhist New Age crowd who have managed to step out of their Judeo-Christian upbringing. There's just enough merit in their notions of enlightenment to make it sell. But at the end of the day, you're either a caterpillar or a butterfly. And the only way anyone will ever have even the slightest sense of what it means to be a butterfly is to become one. There are no butterfly experts among the caterpillars, despite innumerable claims to the contrary. And I encourage my students to at least consider the possibility that the world is up to its poles in caterpillars who quite successfully convince themselves and others that they are actually butterflies. Or, to say it plainly, the vast majority of the world's authorities on enlightenment are themselves not enlightened. They may be something, but they're not awake. An easy way to distinguish between caterpillars and butterflies is to remember that the enlightened don't attach importance to anything, and that enlightenment doesn't require knowledge. It's not about love or compassion or consciousness. It's about truth. Chapter 7. Neither Holy Nor Wise. When the mind is at peace, the world, too, is at peace. Nothing real, nothing absent. Not holding on to reality, not getting stuck in the void. You are neither holy nor wise, just an ordinary fellow who has completed his work. Layman Pang. Marla comes and sits with me during today's quiet period. She's a little self-conscious and gives me an uncertain sidelong glance, as if not believing that it's really okay for her to be here. I don't think I put out much of a guru vibe, but I guess I must put out something because everyone reacts in a similar, reverential sort of way. I don't dress like a guru, and I don't talk like one. I don't carry flowers, perform miracles, smile beatifically, or radiate anything that I'm aware of. I think of myself as a pretty laid-back guy with only the weakest grasp of what it means to be a human among humans. It's like I can hum a few bars, but I've forgotten most of the words. I can't stand in line at the grocery and carry on a normal conversation if it gets much past the weather. I can't go to a bar and have a beer and shoot a game of pool because I can't pretend to share the experiences and interests of the other patrons. In other words, there's no commonality. Commonality at this level is so basic that it's probably not possible to imagine what it's like when it's not shared. No two humans could have less in common than any human and me. I am a member of no community. Because I live in a different paradigm, I am effectively set apart from humanity. Yep, here comes the vampire analogy again. When humans become vampires, they make a trade, even though they don't really understand what they're giving up or what they're getting into. Perhaps irresistible forces compel them, as they did me. To be enlightened, just to take the first step on the actual journey toward enlightenment, is to be henceforth and forever excluded from the whole human thing. I knew when I started on my own journey that it meant leaving behind human connectedness, and that was perfectly acceptable to me. No one gets to that point without being prepared, however naively, to pay the price. I actually don't care to be around Marla very much, not because she won't make any progress from her perspective while she's here, which she won't, and not because she'll quickly leave for the next cool-sounding spiritual adventure, which she will, but because the particular flavor, for want of a better word, of her ego is off-putting. Marla cloaks herself in spirituality rather than dealing with the fear she seeks to conceal. It's always fear beneath the surface, of course, no matter how it manifests. With Marla, the fear revolves around money and security and relationships and vanity, all boiling down to fear of rejection and loneliness, which further boils down to the black diamond at the heart of all fears, fear of no self. She's very self-possessed on the outside, calm, smooth, convinced that she's a very open and spiritually attuned person. But I'd much rather be with a raving loony who is directly confronting their bullshit than someone who spends all their energy repressing it. The cloaking thing always strikes a tinny note that would register as jarring and discordant to anyone able to hear it. Here's the most directly I am able to say this. The one and only truth of any person lies like a black hole at their very core. And everything else, is just the rubbish and debris that covers the hole. Of course, to someone who is just going about their normal human existence undistracted by the larger questions, that rubbish and debris is everything that makes them who they are. But to someone who wants to get to the truth, who they are is what's in the way. All fear is ultimately fear of this inner black hole, and nothing on this side of that hole is true. The process of achieving enlightenment is about breaking through the blockage and stepping through the hole, and anything that's not about getting to and through the hole is just more rubbish and debris. "I had an experience in meditation I want to share with you," Marla begins, and proceeds to reel off a string of insights that she feels aids her in becoming free of something or other. Or maybe she's overcome an obstacle or slain a dragon or something. I know within the first few words that she's trying to impress me so that I will reward her with praise. It's a common enough dynamic. She assumes we have an unspoken agreement in which her part is to reflect and reinforce my self-image as a great spiritual teacher, so that I, in turn, will reflect and reinforce her self-image as a very spiritual person. She assumes we have this unspoken agreement because she had it with the dozen or so other spiritual teachers, and it's always worked out well. A nice win-win situation. I interrupt. "Have you heard the term meikyo?" I asked her. "Yes. Isn't it like something to do with..." "It's a Zen thing. Very handy term. In Zen, no one is interested in spiritual growth. No one is interested in self-exploration or self-realization. They're not trying to become better people or happier people. They're not following a spiritual path. They're following a wake-the-hell-up path. They're completely focused on the hot and narrow pursuit of enlightenment. There's no consolation prize, no secondary objective. Full awakening is what they signed up for. Of course, as students, they had no real idea of what such a pursuit actually entails. So it's the job of the master to see that they stay on course. With me so far? She nods a little uncertainly. The Tao warns us to beware the flowery trappings of the path, or words to that effect. There are many things to see and do on the path to awakening. It's all new and magical. There are points, for instance, where you can stop and develop what you might consider special powers. Prophecy, telepathy, mediumship, magical arts, plate spinning, whatever. During Zen meditation, Zazen, the student might merge into timeless unity consciousness. He might unravel all the complexities of his life in a single glorious sitting. He might feel that he has vomited a gigantic ball of molten lead that has resided in his chest for years. He might descend into the pits of hell and slay all his demons. After such experiences, he might run to his master to share his victories and experiences, thinking he's well on the road to enlightenment, only to have the master splash him with cold water by calling it Meikyo. Marla is frowning now, realizing that she's the one being splashed with cold water. When a Zen master uses the term Meikyo, he's telling his students that the precious gems they're stopping to pick up or the pretty flowers they're pausing to collect only have value or beauty in the world they've chosen to leave behind. The Tao says, beware the flowery trappings, because in order to possess them or benefit from them, you must cease your journey. Stay in the dream. Ultimately, they're just a distraction from the tricky business of waking up. Breaking free of delusion takes everything you have. The price of truth is everything. Everything. That's the rule, and it's inviolable. She looks sad. I continue in a gentler tone. I'm explaining Meikyo because this is what's happening here. You have had some profound insights in meditation, and you've brought them to me. Understandably so. Western spirituality seems to equate enlightenment with self-perfection, so it's natural to assume that ridding yourself of mental and emotional baggage is the way to go. But what I'm telling you is that within the context of searching for enlightenment, your experiences are Meikyo. You bring me these priceless jewels, and I'm telling you that you should flush them down the toilet and move on. I pause to let that sink in. The point here is less to aid Marla in her quest for enlightenment than to help her see that she's not on one. I sometimes wonder if I would make a good Zen master, Roshi, but I don't think so. Or maybe I'd be a great one. Depends on how you look at it. My emblem would be the graphic depiction of the Buddha's head lanced on a pike, complete with dripping blood and dangling viscera. The motto beneath the emblem would be Die. Students would line up outside my door after Zazen to come in and tell me their experiences, and as soon as the first one opened his mouth, I'd start shrieking at the top of my lungs, "You're not him! You're not the real guy! You're the Meikyo guy! You're just the dream character!" I'd probably start hitting the student with a stick at this point, which is one of the perks of being a Zen master. "You're supposed to be dead. Why aren't you dead? Why are you coming to see me? You're the problem. Get out and come back when you're dead. That's the guy I want to talk to, not a stupid dream character. Now get out!" That essentially defines the quest for enlightenment. The you that you think of as you, and that thinks of you as you, and so on, is not you. It's just the character that the underlying truth of you is dreaming into brief existence. Enlightenment isn't in the character. It's in the underlying truth. Now, there's nothing wrong with being a dream character, of course, unless it's your goal to wake up, in which case the dream character must be ruthlessly annihilated. If your desire is to experience transcendental bliss or supreme love or altered states of consciousness or awaken kundalini or to qualify for heaven or to liberate all sentient beings or simply to become the best dang person you can be, then rejoice. You're in the right place, the dream state, the dualistic universe. However, if your interest is to cut the crap and figure out what's true, then you're in the wrong place. And you've got a very messy fight ahead, and there's no point in pretending otherwise. That earlier paragraph, the one with Buddha's head and me screaming at students that they should be dead and all that, that's not why I think I wouldn't make a good Zen master. In fact, that's why I think I'd make a really cool Zen master. The bad part would stem from what I suspect would prove to be poor student retention. As it happens, I'm a very nice guy with an easygoing teaching style and laudable student retention, and if I had a banner or emblem, it would probably be a minimalist version of the Fool card in Tarot, the fool striding blissfully off the cliff and into the void. As a Zen master, my job would be to infuse in students total knowledge of the Absolute. That may sound like a tall order until you stop to consider the fact that it doesn't require knowledge to be enlightened any more than it requires knowledge to obey the law of gravity or to be bathed in sunlight. Since enlightenment is nothing more than truth realization, it doesn't take much to figure out that if anything requires knowledge and effort and seemingly superhuman powers of imagination, it's not truth, but delusion. And if anything is so wildly improbable as to defy belief, it's not the vast ocean or the billions of fish in it, but the inability of those fish to locate water. I hear a sniffle. Marla feels rebuked. The master has diminished her offering. That's how she should feel. Those Zen students aren't getting the giggles when the stick comes down. Why do you think I'm telling you this, Marla?
I don't know. So I can transcend the common, so I can move past, you know, so I can...
We're talking about two different things here, Marla, okay? You think I'm telling you that the insights you've had in meditation are Meikyo, right? She looks at me and nods. No, not at all. This is an important distinction. I'm saying that the insights you've had are Meikyo in the context of waking up. See, unlike me, the Zen master knows exactly why his students are there. He doesn't have to ask. But it's not like that here, so I'm asking you now, what is your desire? She starts to say something, but I cut her off. The universe will give you whatever you want, Marla. That's how it works, even if you don't know it. It can't be otherwise. You don't have to be worthy, but you do have to know what it is you want. You have to focus. Try to do that. Try writing out what it is you want and condensing it down until you've reduced it to a concise statement of desire or intent. Your path can only be meandering and your life a blur until you do that. Come talk to me when you have something, okay? She nods. And Marla, I think being a good mom for that little girl would be a perfectly good answer. She nods and smiles and hugs me. She gets it.
I'm sure it hurts to have the master say that her profoundly moving insights are shit. But she gets it. That's good.
Chapter 8. I don't do heart. The most useful piece of learning for the uses of life is to unlearn what is untrue. Antisthenes. My monologues tend to be a little loose, but they could easily be a lot looser. It takes a conscious effort on my part to stay on track and not follow every tempting digression. I like to follow the course dictated by my initial impression of what a student needs to hear, and I usually end by putting the ball in their court. I can say it, and they can nod and agree, but that doesn't do any good at all. If you want to benefit from knowledge, you have to own it for yourself, and the only way to do that is to fight for it. Emerson said, "No man thoroughly understands a truth until he has contended against it." Having the answer isn't enough. You have to do the math. The chair Marla vacated does not stay empty for long. A 50-something engineer named Arthur appears and waits for permission to sit down, which I give with a slight gesture. That may seem overly formal, but for Arthur, it's actually an improvement. The first time Arthur came to speak with me, he sat in a half lotus at my feet, which made me a little buggy. After I coaxed him up into a chair, we spent an hour disabusing him of his tendency to equate enlightenment with divinity. It's still hardwired into his thinking that the teacher must be regarded as an elevated being, so he never sits without permission and always speaks with formality. Arthur doesn't live in the house, but he's a frequent visitor, especially in spring when the gardens need so much help. Arthur tells me he wants a technique. Rather, he wants the technique. I really only have one technique, and everybody who comes to the house soon learns what it is from other students. But, oddly, nobody seems to practice it until they receive it from me. I've laid it out many times and tried to put it in the public domain for the use of whoever wants it, but it has remained strangely proprietary, as if the only way it can work is if it comes directly from me. There's really not much to it, but I guess there's not much to closing your eyes and repeating a mantra or counting your breaths either. "Okay, Arthur," I begin. "The technique is called spiritual autolysis. Autolysis means self-digestion, and spiritual means hell. I don't really know. Let's say it means that level of self which encompasses the mental, physical, and emotional aspects. Put the two words together, and you have a process through which you feed yourself, one piece at a time, into the purifying digestive fires." "May I ask a question?" Arthur asks. "Yes, Arthur." "You make spiritual autolysis sound rather unpleasant." "Yes, Arthur. It's an unpleasant process." "Oh, I see. Thank you." "You're welcome. The process of spiritual autolysis is basically like a Zen koan on steroids. All you really have to do is write the truth." "Write the truth?" "Sounds simple, doesn't it?" "Yes, that's all there is to it. Just write down what you know is true, or what you think is true, and keep writing until you've come up with something that is true." "There are 360 degrees in a circle," says Arthur. "Sure," I agree. "Start with something as seemingly indisputable as that, and then start examining the foundation upon which that statement is built, and just keep following it down until you've reached bedrock, something solid, true." "There aren't 360 degrees in a circle?" he asks. "The question presupposes that there's a circle."
There's not a circle? Maybe. I don't know. Is there? Well, if I draw a circle, I, when did you confirm the existence of an I? Draw. Have you already raced past the part where you confirmed that you are a separate physical being in a physical universe with the ability to perceive, to draw? Have you already confirmed duality as truth? Arthur is thoughtful and silent for several moments. I guess that's what you mean by following it down. This is very confusing. I don't even know where to start. It doesn't matter where you start. You could start by using Ramana Maharishi's query, "Who am I?" or "What is me?" and then just work at it. Just try to say something true and keep at it until you do. Write and rewrite. Make it cleaner and cut out the excess and ego and follow it wherever it leads until you're done. And how long does that usually take? I would think a couple of years, but when you're done, you're done. And by done, you mean done. Oh, is this like journaling, like keeping a diary? Ah, good question. No, this isn't about personal awareness or self-exploration. It's not about feelings or insights. It's not about personal or spiritual evolution. This is about what you know for sure, about what you are sure you know is true, about what you are that is true. With this process, you tear away layer after layer of untruth masquerading as truth. Anytime you go back to read something you wrote, even if it was only yesterday, you should be surprised by how far you've come since then. It's actually a painful and vicious process, somewhat akin to self-mutilation. It creates wounds that will never heal and burns bridges that can never be rebuilt. And the only real reason to do it is because you can no longer stand not to. He lets that sink in for a few moments. What's the reason for writing it down? Why not just do it in your head like with koans? That's another good question. Yes, koans and mantras are done in your head. Ramana Maharishi's "Who am I?" query is done in your head. The reason for writing it down on paper or on a computer where you can see it is because the brain, unlikely as it may sound, is no place for serious thinking. Anytime you have serious thinking to do, the first step is to get the whole shooting match out of your head and set it up someplace where you can walk around it and see it from all sides. Attack, switch sides, and counterattack. You can't do that while it's still in your head. Writing it out allows you to act as your own teacher, your own critic, your own opponent. By externalizing your thoughts, you can become your own guru, judging yourself, giving feedback, providing a more objective and elevated perspective. Arthur is looking at me questioningly, so I continue. You're an engineer, right?
Yes.
And you engineer what?
Bridges.
In your head? Arthur pauses a moment to consider.
Yes and no, he says.
Okay, you're saying yes because there's a process of conceptualization, right? The idea stage?
There is, yes.
And other internal creative and problem-solving stages along the way?
Yes.
And then what? What's after the initial conceptualization?
Well, then there are the meetings and preliminary drawings and more meetings and the project managers.
The creative process at work.
Well, yes.
So basically, it starts as an idea, a thought in someone's head, and ends up as a real bridge somewhere in the real world.
Yes.
And along the way, it evolves, takes shape, comes into focus, right? It moves from idea to rough sketches
to highly precise drawings and scale models, to an actual bridge that will last 100 years. Something like that?
Something like that, yes.
And that's the creative process. Thought to reality. It's always the same process, whether it's a bridge, a poem, the space shuttle, or your life. Does that make sense?
Okay, yes.
You recognize that from your own life, your own work?
Yes, I do.
Could that all happen in someone's head? One person's head?
Arthur laughs.
Certainly not. No. Thought, whether in the brain or out, is a creative tool, and spiritual autolysis is a creative process, just like any other, just like building a bridge. But bridge builders are very educated men, Arthur points out. It's both an art and a science, and it can take a lifetime to fully develop. Creative endeavor is erected on a foundation of knowledge and experience.
Absolutely, I reply,
and I can assure you that while you're in this process of self-digestion, you're going to develop a voracious appetite for all sorts of knowledge, religious, esoteric, metaphysical, spiritual, New Age, Eastern and Western philosophy, all that and more. You'll be relying on the knowledge and experience of men and women from throughout history without regard to race or nationality, but your search will take you far beyond human intelligence. Truth transcends time and boundaries, and so will your search for it. You'll definitely want a good library or used bookstore nearby. Does that make spiritual autolysis a path of intellect as opposed to a path of heart or a path of devotion or a path of service?
Ugh.
Frankly, you start losing me a little bit there, Arthur. He gives me a perplexed look. I don't know what all these different paths are, Arthur. Spiritual autolysis is an intellectual endeavor, but I balk at calling it a path of intellect. It's a process of discrimination, of unknowing what is untrue, of progressively stripping away the false and leaving only what is true. Discrimination is used in a machete-like manner for hacking one's way through the dense underbrush of delusion, or, if you prefer, in a sword-like manner for hacking off one's own delusion-riddled head. Intellect is used as the sword with which ego commits a slow and agonizing suicide, the death of a thousand cuts. Whether that makes it this kind of path or that kind of path doesn't concern us here. That's something for a student of paths to worry about. If the question stays with you, then it's something you can address for yourself in the process of spiritual autolysis. I used to be pretty well versed in spiritual literature, and I recall that there's a lot of talk about different paths. But from where I sit, it's just another way of distracting yourself from the difficult work of breaking free. No theory of paths is of any practical value in waking up. The very idea that there is a set path, much less a choice of paths, that one need merely follow is ruinously misleading. In short, this path business is just another case of the blind leading the blind, part of the vast mythology created by caterpillars teaching caterpillars how to become butterflies. Arthur interrupts my thoughts.
I read that Don Juan said...
Whoa! I jump in. Hold up a sec. Is this going to be the path with heart thing?
Yes.
I'm familiar with the Carlos Castaneda book in which Don Juan advises Carlito to choose a path with heart. I am familiar with it for the same reason that so many spiritual seekers are familiar with it, because it has that ring of sagely goodness that makes it the one thing out of all of Castaneda's writings that gets widely remembered. Does that make it true or valuable? Obviously not. Just another cliché.
just another piece of pretty misdirection. I am well aware that a great many of the world's most popular spiritual doctrines advocate a heart-centered approach to spiritual development. But popularity among the soundly asleep may not be the best criterion by which to judge a method for waking up. Let me state it plainly, Arthur. I don't do heart. To the extent that I advocate any path, it is a path without heart, devoid of compassion, totally free of any thought for others whatsoever. The thinking is simple. Wake up first. Wake up, and then you can double back and perhaps be of some use to others if you still have the urge. Wake up first with pure and unapologetic selfishness, or you're just another shipwrecked victim floundering in the ocean, and all the compassion in the world is of absolutely no use to the other victims floundering around you. Resolve your own situation first, and then maybe your compassion will translate into something of value to others. I suppose that sounds cruel or unspiritual or whatever, but it only works the way it works. Make sense? Arthur nods thoughtfully. Hey, you've probably visited those foundries where they pour the molten steel that goes into those bridges of yours, right?
Certainly. Many times.
Man, those places are scary looking. They make hell look like Aspen. You reckon there's a lot of different ways they could do that work, and they choose the one with heart?
Arthur chuckles.
Hardly. Of course not, because it works the way it works. This waking up thing isn't all sweetness and light. It's a serious business, with a failure rate that's nearly absolute. Think about that. You're embarking on an undertaking that millions upon millions of sincere, intelligent men and women have committed their lives to without success. That's a pretty sobering statement. This is a process, and it works the way it works, or it doesn't work at all. You can't dictate terms. Preferences are irrelevant.
It sounds like you're saying I may not even want to think of helping others once I, myself, am liberated.
I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. Depends on how you're wired, I suppose. You see what I do? This teaching thing, right? He nods. Maybe you'll do something like this. Maybe you'll teach. Or maybe you'll go back to building bridges and just keep it to yourself.
Hard to imagine, he says.
It's impossible to imagine. But you're putting the cart before the horse. The simple fact is that you are of no use to anyone else if you're in the same situation they are.
Jesus, he mutters.
It's the most colorful language I've ever heard him use. Here's a thought, I continue. When you're doing the writing, spiritual autolysis, do it for someone else. Write it for someone else. Express your knowledge for someone else's benefit. Write it for publication, as if the whole world will see it. Or write it as a series of letters to your son, or to an imaginary friend, or to the child you once were. Whatever. Use the process of spiritual autolysis as a means of expressing your own highest knowledge for someone else's benefit. And, of course, keep improving it until you've stated the truth.
Which I'll never do?
What? State the truth?
Of course not.
The house is rising out of a quiet period now, and over the course of 15 minutes it is transformed from a silent meditation hall into a bustling restaurant and social club. I'm amazed to see that there are over 30 people here, including a few I don't recall seeing before.
And I wonder if some show up just for Saneya's cooking.
The Krishna consciousness folks put a major emphasis on cuisine, and I wouldn't be surprised if many of their members initially stopped in just to see what smelled so good.
Saneya is a master chef who would be welcomed with open arms by any Indian restaurant in the world.
When she is cooking, I regret that I have such a small appetite. I think I should talk about myself a little more, not to demonstrate how remarkable I am, but how ordinary. Obviously, I haven't always been an enlightened guy. I was a cute baby, a happy kid, a problem teen, and a wayward adult. No one looked at me back then and figured me for the future wisdom heart of a rural America ashram project. On the other hand, I have always possessed something of an insightful nature. I started struggling with cogito ergo sum in my early teens. Throughout my teens and into my 20s, I wrote short stories and essays that were trial assaults on the nature of reality, which helped me bring my thinking into focus. My thunderbolt epiphany came in my late 20s, around 50 pages into reading my first book of a distinctly spiritual nature. As all good epiphanies should, this one struck my brain like a bullet of light and redefined my entire life in a single instant. The realization was nothing more or less than this: truth exists. I was absolutely stunned. The lines of my being were redrawn in a flash. I was staggered by this simple statement, by the sheer absurdity of it. After all, how can someone not realize that truth exists? But the truth is, I didn't. My thoughts were so constantly turned toward denying what wasn't that I was effectively blinded to what was. The very act of fighting for liberation had imprisoned me. In order to oppose the false, I had to dwell in the half-light where falseness thrives. Finally, understanding that truth existed was the equivalent of crawling out of a putrid sewer and into sunlight. Sunlight, the existence of which I should have suspected all along, but never quite did. But now I was in the sunlight, and it was totally mind-blowing. In that moment, I was finally born. End of Disc 2.